Mastermind Agent is proud to present the Interview of the Month Club. Top agents, rising agents, team members, and guests from across North America reveal their success secrets, strategies, and systems in up-close and personal interviews. You can find all the club interviews at www.mastermindagent.com.
Hi, I'm Mike Cerrone with Mastermind Agent. This month's rising agent is Brandon Hunt with Show Appeal Realty in Tempe, Arizona. He works the Metro Phoenix market and has been an agent for 7 years. Last year, Brandon closed 52 transactions with a total sales volume of $11.7 million. His average sales price was $228,000. 3% were buyers and 97% were sellers. He operates as an individual agent, a sole practitioner. Brandon is a true entrepreneur. He operates a unique business model with two sides. On side one, Brandon owns a traditional brokerage company. On side two, Brandon manages a fix and flip investor business. Brandon's traditional brokerage company is called Show Appeal Realty, which has a professional stager on staff. He hired a professional manager to run the day-to-day operation. Brandon focuses his efforts on lead generation, follow-up, and infrastructure systems for his 27 agents. Pay attention to his buyer lead generation system utilizing the latest in search engine optimization, SEO strategies, and internet data exchange IDX syndication to generate 30,000 unique visitors per month and 8 to 13 hot buyer leads per day. Not bad for a company that's only been around for a year and a half. Brandon's fix and flip investor business is called Nuff Said Enterprises. He identified a need in the market for clean, beautiful, fixed up, and ready-to-move-in homes. He teamed up with an investor. Brandon provides the management, the investor provides the money. Together, they buy foreclosure homes at the courthouse steps, fix them up, and sell them fast. The typical transaction is only 8 weeks from buy to fix to sell, all in a declining market. Typically, he has 13 to 17 homes on the books and manages 3 construction crews simultaneously. Brandon thinks outside the box. Welcome to the call, Brandon.
Hi, thank you, Mike.
Brandon, before we get started in what you're doing now, let's go back for a minute to your pre-agent life and talk about what were you doing before you got into real estate?
Prior to real estate, I had just graduated college at Indiana University at the Kelley School of Business, with a major in marketing. I came out to Arizona, having never been to Arizona before, and I was networking with the alumni network for Indiana University and came across a salesperson that had been in the business for 15 years. And this was back in 2004 when the market out here in Arizona was booming. And he was looking to expand his business. So I came on board his team to mentor under him and get used to the business and get to know the business from someone that had been in it for 15 years.
So you basically jumped right in from college. You didn't have any jobs that you did prior to real estate.
Prior to real estate, no. I mean, I had a couple jobs here and there throughout college. You know, telemarketing was one of them, probably the worst job I ever had to do. But it actually gets you comfortable on the phone, which is actually a good lead into real estate. You know, I worked at a factory one summer. I bussed tables and washed dishes at a restaurant. So I've kind of been through all the jobs a normal teenager and college student would go through.
You started this business 7 years ago. Why did you decide to get into real estate? Was it because of the chat with the mentor, or did you already decide you wanted to get into real estate prior to that?
Well, that's a good question. I really never could foresee myself going into real estate prior to meeting my mentor in 2004. I always thought I'd graduate college with a good degree. I'd go into corporate America and work my way up that route. But it was such a great opportunity that I just could not pass up. I mean, the market was booming. It was a great way to learn the business and become an entrepreneur, which really at heart is what I am.
When you got started, did you have a fast start in the business or a slow start in the business?
When I started, I had a very fast start to the business. I think in 2005, I closed around 33 transactions, all buyer transactions, out-of-state relocations. So 33 transaction, I think the average sales price was somewhere in the low $200,000. So at that time, just getting out of college, closing that volume at that price point was a pretty good fast start for me in my real estate career.
Describe the current real estate market in Tempe, Arizona.
Well, the current real estate market here is just full of great opportunity. Prices are at historically low prices where you can get great cash flow, great appreciation in the market in future years, especially if inflation sets in. So other agents might look at the market and say, it's depressed. There's a lot of distressed sales. I look at it and I see opportunity to generate revenue. And especially in this market, if you can figure out the best niche to be in to generate the best return on investment, it can be very lucrative for you. And it's all about how you leverage that niche to generate transactions, because it's generating transactions that really will help grow your business.
So you've taken advantage of these low prices to generate positive cash flows.
Exactly. When I started in 2008, I saw a niche in the real estate market here in Arizona. This was before I got into the investment side of my business, which is what I do today. I was taking some buyers out, and they were first-time home buyers, and they didn't have a lot of capital reserves, just enough to put down a down payment and cover closing costs. And the market started to shift to being a lot of distressed properties, short sales in particular, which I'm sure everyone's familiar with by now. And they just could not wait 6 months to figure out if they were going to get the house or not. They had to be on a 30-day, close of escrow schedule. And we went and viewed some bank-owned homes, REOs at that time, that were pretty beat up. They were just not move-in ready. And my clients only had the capital to put down the down payment, the closing costs, and didn't have the extra $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 to reinvest in the property to get it move-in ready. So that's when the light bulb went off, per se, in my head and said, well, there has to be a way to provide a product that's in move-in ready condition that can close in 30 days. I mean, it's not a novel concept, but it just was not out there in the marketplace for what the buyers were looking for. So I did some investigating and found the best way to purchase real estate at the rock bottom prices is at trustee sales. Trustee sales are the sales that are sold at the courthouse steps that are auctioned off to the highest bidder. So I approached an investor and of this idea and this niche market, and he said, I believe that you might be onto something. And he seeded me with $600,000 in capital. And I just took that capital, I purchased some properties, I got a crew of contractors and subcontractors to fix up and rehab the property, and in turn would resell them for a profit to the buyers that were looking for that property or that kind of need in the market.
Why don't we take a second at this point and tell our listeners that there are two parts to your business now that you've developed. One, you have a traditional brokerage where you're the broker, and you have how many agents underneath you?
I have 27 agents, and I actually hire out the broker in my company. I don't need that kind of responsibility, I guess, and it's better off having someone that can devote the time to the agents and the paperwork that's needed.
So you have a managing broker on your brokerage side, and then you have a separate business that you run where you're developed this idea of taking these properties from the trustee sale, fixing them up, and sell them to move-in ready buyers.
Yes, exactly.
And the name of your brokerage business is?
Show Appeal Realty.
And the name of your fix and flip business is?
Nusted Enterprises.
Throughout this interview, we'll try to talk about both sides of the business. They're both rather exciting. Since we started on Nuff Said, let's talk a little more about that. It seems like you found a niche and you've developed it. You started that in 2008 And it sounds like you've grown that. Now, you said you started with an investor initially. Are you still working with that investor?
Yes, that investor is still my partner today, and we've done approximately 135 flips from that beginning in mid-2008. And a lot of people questioned, you know, whether you could flip in a declining market. Of course, the market here in Arizona and Phoenix in particular has dropped considerably since 2008. From the time we started flipping, but we're flipping at such a fast rate and not being subject to market fluctuations that we're able to move the properties off our books before we were getting hit with the price depreciation in the market. So as long as you have the right systems in place, you can standardize your materials, you can expedite the fix-up and rehab process, you can move properties in a declining market for a profit.
How quickly are you able to move them from the time you purchase them and take possession to the time you can find a buyer?
Well, our typical rehab depends on obviously the condition of the property. We'll do anything from a simple paint job, carpet clean, all the way up to putting in walls and flooring and cabinetry, the whole nine. But on average, I would say we have about a 2 to 3 week rehab on a house. And then we have an average days on market of 15 days. So we're pricing these things aggressively to move. We're not getting greedy with the price, which is what I see a lot of people do. They try to stretch that dollar as much as possible, then turn, they're shooting themselves in the foot. So we have an average of 2.5 weeks, 6 up to 3 weeks. We have 15 days on the market, and then we have a typical 30-day close of escrow. So we're moving these things off the books anywhere 7 to 9 weeks.
And you said you're pricing these things aggressively. If the fair market value is $100,000, are you trying to take a percentage off of that as a general rule to be aggressive?
Well, I wouldn't say it that way because our products are at such a premium. On a $100,000 house, a buyer might not expect to find granite countertops in it or stainless steel appliances or travertine backsplash or some of the little things that we do to be a selling feature, I guess, what I would say, for a buyer to be really attracted to it compared to what else is on the market, which is typically a short sell or an REO that doesn't have these kind of extra features and amenities that our houses have. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily we're trying to discount below the market value. Obviously, we try to maximize the return on what someone's willing to pay for it. And it's some of the little things that we do to our houses and some of the quality control that we have on our product and on our fix-up that sets us apart, and we're able to sell it, you know, obviously at a premium over an REO or a bank-owned house, but still with what an appraiser, you could justify to an appraiser that the value of that house is worth. And that's why they move so fast, because of the condition of the property, and they're priced right to the market.
On the sell, the final sell, do you have any challenges getting these appraisers to come up to the price that you want when they see that you just bought it a couple months earlier for such a low price?
Sure, there's always obstacles, but you know, you make money in flipping when you buy, not when you sell. So as long as you're buying right and you can justify the comps on what it should resell for when you buy, and you have your margin built in, obviously, you can make a profit. Now, dealing with appraisers, obviously we have a repair list, you know, that details everything that we've done to the property to increase the value since the purchase. We have comps, comparable properties that we share with the appraiser out there to help justify the price. But in the end, you know, if we're putting, you know, $20,000 worth of rehab in a property, if normal Joe and Mary Smith homeowner went to go put those same upgrades that we put in, it would cost them $40,000 instead of $20,000. So there's a lot of our margin just because of our cost positioning with our vendors and suppliers. We're able to get things at such a great cost that a normal homeowner cannot compete with, since we're doing it on such a large scale, which is really a huge added value to our business model.
Do you try to purchase these properties at a certain percentage below where you think the final retail value will be? Do you use some kind of formula in your purchase and what properties would or would not qualify for you to make a bid at the trustee sale?
Sure. I look at it as my net return on investment, and I want a minimum of 10%. So if I'm investing $100,000, I have to make $10,000. $200,000, I have to make $20,000. That's the way I look at it. And, you know, at the end of the day, what am I going to walk away with? And obviously, there's certain properties, areas, features to a house that I will not buy. And there are certain things I look for in a house that I will pay a premium for. For example, I won't buy anything that backs up to a major road or a power line or a big commercial complex, anything that would really limit the number of buyers. I want to appeal to the mass. So I don't want to take that buyer pool and shrink it at all. I want it as large as possible. And some of the things on the contrary that I do look for is single-story homes. In the Arizona market, we've had a huge influx of Canadian buyers, and these are second-time home buyers that are looking for single-family homes, great room floor plans. They're looking for communities that have some amenities like a swimming pool or hiking and biking trails, a golf course. So I'm really targeting out certain communities and certain floor plans and features of homes that would appeal to what I think the buyer would be. And even in 2008, 2009, when FHA did not have the waiver for home buyers, you had to have title season for 90 days, it didn't affect my business model at all because what I was buying was not appealing to the first-time home buyer. So I would be able to still resell all my properties to non-FHA buyers, being cash or conventional buyers, where I wouldn't get stuck with having to hold them for 90 days before I could resell them. So it's really targeting not only what you don't want to look for that would hinder the amount of buyers to that property, but also what you would attract as a buyer to purchase that home.
That's smart. You're looking at the end first.
Exactly. It's reverse engineering it.
Who's doing the work? Are you going out there and doing the work, or do you have somebody that's doing the work for you?
I run about three crews that do all the work for me. Typically, I'll own about 13 to 17 homes at any given time. And that's in the fix and flip process. You know, four or five might be coming soon to the market where we're going through rehab on them. A couple might be on the market active. Then we'll have, you know, seven or eight pending, waiting for a close of escrow. So I always try to keep a pipeline going for my contractors and my crew because, you know, one of the reasons I'm able to command such great cost savings from my suppliers is the fact that they're not out there hunting for the next job. I've already got it lined up for them. So it's really controlling that process and having the right crew in place because, you know, bottom line is they're the lifeblood of my business. If I didn't have them to do the work and didn't have the relationship with the same contractor for the past 3 years, it would make my job very, very much more challenging. Because I, you know, when I buy a house, my contractor already knows exactly what needs to be done to it. I don't have to go to the house and handhold them through it and saying, oh, you know, the paint has to be this color. Everything in our business is standardized. From we use the same flooring to the same fans to the same granite to the same fixtures. You name it, everything is standardized.
Do you purchase all of that product ahead of time, or do you have it in a big warehouse, or are you doing it as you go?
That's a very good question. And I guess it's leading into one of my next businesses that we're looking at sourcing. Right now, we are one of Lowe's largest purchasers here in the metro area. And we've been able to, with our volume, command significant price reductions over what a normal contractor or home buyer would purchase at their stores. And that's mainly for fixtures, fans and lighting and stuff like that. Now, we are able to buy our granite and warehouse it at a significant cost savings. When a granite place in the local area was going out of business, we would buy up 30 slabs and keep them in warehouse to when we need to use it. And the next step of our business model is really to start sourcing some of this material from China. and really start to really warehouse this and create a company that's just geared towards investors and buy and hold investors and fix and flip investors. Because you know what? They're just standardizing. They don't care. They don't need 40 different fans to choose from. They need two fans. They don't need 40 different choices on granite. They need one granite at a great price. So there's a lot of other interesting business models that can feed off of this, which is it's a very compelling reason why we're looking at doing some of the sourcing from China now.
You talked about the investor early on. Would you mind telling us what type of arrangement did you have with the investor? He put up the money and you did the work. Do you split the profits? Does he get paid back first? You know, what kind of arrangement did you structure that somebody else wanted to duplicate what you're doing?
Well, this investor, I have an arrangement worked out where it's a 50-50 split on the profit. He puts up the money. I manage the buy, the sell, the project management, the rehab, the whole nine, and it's split 50-50. Now, since then, we have grown our business to accommodate other investors. Other people that the private money that is looking to get a better return than what they can get, you know, on the stock market and money markets out there, in which we can provide that. Some of the arrangements we've done with them is a 50-50 split with our company. They put the money. Same thing. We manage the whole project from buy to sell. They are not influencing our decision making whatsoever, because we have the track record proven. That we know what we're doing and we have that credibility built up. So it's not a question of, are you pricing that at 225 or 250, 215? It's, you know, this is what it is and this is what we're doing to the project, which I think is key for a lot of people. I know it would take a lot of credibility to get built up, but once you get a system in place and you have that track record, you can kind of command that respect from an investor. Now we have other investors that want to do some of the project management themselves. So all we're doing is the buy and the resell for them. And that you can split it, you know, however you want. You can take a quarter of the equity of the profitability, or you can just command a higher, you know, you can get it either on the buy side, you can get a little spiff, or you can get it on the resale side, on the real estate commission, you can also make some money. So there's different ways to tweak the model depending on what the investor is looking for.
When you're participating in these transactions, are you working for free on the commission side? Is that part of the big picture, or are you charging a fee when you sell these properties?
When I sell the properties for my own company and for the other investors, we do not charge a real estate commission. It's a simple 3% to the buyer's agent that brings us the deal on the buyer, and that's it. We split. I mean, we look at splitting the profitability straight down the middle from you know what it would cost to what the rehab is to what the net return on investment is, and that's what we're splitting 50-50.
Are you buying these properties in one company, or do you have multiple companies for each of these investor arrangements?
We buy them, invest them into the investor's company. So, you know, if it's ABC Realty or ABC Buyer, we vest the title of the property into their name, and then we have a separate agreement worked out with them through you know, obviously through our lawyers at state. You know, we will be purchasing, investing the property in their entity. However, this is how the transaction works. If they decide not to flip or resell the property, they're owed a commission to us, 3%. So there's different ways we have to protect it, but the investor has to feel that their investment is secured in some fashion, and a deed of trust will do that.
Who's on the deed?
The investor is on the deed of trust. Yeah, exactly. And we just have I don't know what you want to call it, but an arrangement or agreement that will say, you know, it's just a kind of a rider that we put on the property address, and they re-sign it saying that, you know, this is the arrangement that we have on the fix-up and the rehab of the property, that the profits will be split 50-50.
Are you buying these investments with cash, or are the investors getting financing for part of it?
All of them are cash transactions. When you buy at the trustee sale, It's 24 hours to have the cash available to close on the transaction. Of course, they're as is, and typically they're occupied or you don't know the status of it. That's why it's important to, you know, do as much due diligence as possible prior to bidding on the property. You know, you want to try to get eyes on the property. You want to try to check title, make sure you're not bidding on a second, or there's not any kind of tax liens against the property that would really hinder your ability to sell it. So there is a due diligence phase that you have to have some confidence to know how you can eliminate as much risk as possible. But on the other side is you have to take risks to make money in this market. And I talk with a lot of real estate agents that want to do what I'm doing, and the biggest thing I find is they don't either want to put in the work or they're too scared of the risk to jump in and do it and just roll up the sleeves and get your hands dirty. And without those two things, you're not going to be successful in this niche market.
I want to go back just for clarification. Maybe it's only me, but understanding how you're buying these properties with the investors, the deed is the ownership. The deed of trust is a lien against that ownership. So is the ownership name, the deed going into the investor's name, and then your business is taking a deed of trust or a lien against the property? Is that how it's working?
Well, that is one way to do it. We have such a longstanding agreement with a lot of the investors that we have in place where we're not putting in a second deed of trust on the property. We're just doing a first, and then we just have our lawyer has drafted up a kind of like an operating agreement, I guess, of some sorts that they're agreeing to allow us to do the rehab on this property with the intent of reselling it for a profit. In the event they don't resell for a profit, they're owed us a 3% commission of the purchase price, a trustee sale. So it is a protection, but it's not as much protection as a second deed of trust would be on the property. And it's really, you know, how much trust do you want to put into who you're working with?
What would happen if the project was a loser for some reason? Do you have something written about that, that if for some reason there's a loss on this transaction, do you and the investor both eat that 50-50?
No, that's the actual risk that the investor's taking, is that they're taking the loss. With our track record, you know, we've only taken three losses and that many properties, and they've been 3,000, 4,000, and one was 15,000. So pretty good odds that we're not going to get a loss, but that's the risk of doing this business, and that's the risk for them of making a, you know, 25-30% annualized return versus making 5% or 8% with their financial advisor.
What have we not talked about that you would like to get out there about your fix and flip business?
Well, I think I mentioned it earlier that you can do the fix and flip in a declining market, and there's huge opportunity out there for this need in the marketplace. And what I like to try to talk to a lot of people, because people look at what we do as they're sharks, they're vultures. And in fact, you know, we're just the opposite. We're the ones that are helping support and stabilize this market. We're the ones that are helping push the values of neighborhoods up. So what if we bought it for $200, but we sell it at $275? That's increasing the value of the neighborhood overall, plus taking a property that's been neglected with weeds growing as tall as the roof, and really putting that TLC back in the house and getting a buyer in there that is going to be a great homeowner for that community. So I think there needs to be a difference of perception from what a flipper was back in the boom, where it was they didn't do anything to earn that equity, or, you know, the market is appreciating. That is how they made the money. This is a true business that we run, and it's actually doing good to the community as a whole.
Have you gotten to the point where you're acting on your own account and you're buying and selling properties in your own name without investors?
No, I have allegiance to my business partner that initially loaned me the funds to get started. And since then, he's secured lines of credit and other sources of getting cheap capital to be able to grow our business to what it is today. So my loyalty is with him, and I would not think about venturing off and just doing something by myself without his approval. Because, you know, face it, without his capital, I could have never got started. And for him, without my knowledge and expertise and running the business, he couldn't have made the returns that he has made. So it's a good win-win relationship that we have that I think is mutually beneficial on both sides.
Are you building any wealth through buy and hold? Are you buying and holding any of these properties?
Well, that's the next business venture that we're getting in our company. In fact, I met with a local community bank about a buy and hold strategy. And it's important the way we looked at starting this business, us being my partner and I. We looked at it saying we want to keep all retained earnings in this company. We're not going to soak this company dry of all the assets. And so what we've done is, you know, just used, whatever tax money we would need. And we've lived off other sources of revenue that we've been able to generate outside of the fix and flip model. And so by doing that, we've got quite a bit of retained earnings in the company and quite a great track record now of 2+ years of tax returns. That we have now approached banks and saying, okay, now what can we do or what can you do for us to leverage what we have built? Because, you know, that's what's key in this market is proper leverage. And with the buy and hold strategy, that you know, we're looking at getting about $1.5 million worth of financing, which would probably take us up to doing 15, 16, 17 homes or so. At an interest rate of 4.1% on a 5-year fixed with no prepayment or penalties. I mean, just a great way to leverage what we've built now into a buy-and-hold strategy. And with that kind of proper leverage at that interest rate, we can get an annualized return of 16 to 20%. Which is just great, and that's not even factoring appreciation in this market. You know, if inflation really is going to set in, these houses, you know, come back at all, which they should, you know, we're going to be sitting pretty in 5 to 7 to 10 years on a buy-and-hold strategy.
And so is that your long-term plan with enough said is to move into the long-term hold as well as, are you going to be doing flips at the same time and long-term or both or one or the other?
We're going to be doing both, and that's one of the arrangements with the local community bank that we've arranged. You know, they can't securely collateralize our fix and flip homes because we move them so fast off the books. It wouldn't make sense from an admin standpoint to secure those properties for the bank. So the way around that is work out a great deal on a buy-and-hold strategy with us. Maybe we don't get the line of credit we wanted for the fix-and-flip model, but we're able to diversify in towards a long-term buy-and-hold strategy that's going to still have great returns for us. So that's just one of the things we're looking at. And I think I mentioned the sourcing materials from China and some of the things we can do. We've also looked at potentially bundling homes into a company and reselling them. You know, a lot of these investors or big funds are not looking for one house or two houses, and a lot of our buyers we're getting are from Canada. So why not bundle, you know, 10, 15 homes into an LLP and have a turnkey property management in place for a investor in Canada or somewhere else in the United States. So it's just one way of leveraging what we do and our capacity to generate other business revenue streams.
Wow, you're really thinking outside the box.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, a successful business just doesn't have one stream of revenue. And we know, you know, the fix and flip strategy might not be around forever, but we got to make hay while the sun's shining and make as much money and return on the fix and flip strategy as possible while also looking towards the future of what the market's going to be like. It's the same reason we got into this fix and flip market, because of the need and predicting that there would be a huge need for it. It's the same way we're going to diversify into other segments, is knowing that this market will change and we're going to be in front of that change.
How are you locating or finding these investors? You've started to branch out from your original partner. Are you actively looking for investors?
We are actually looking for investors, and a lot of it has come by word of mouth. With our real estate brokerage that we now have in place, we've been able to attract real estate agents that are more geared towards the investment side of the business, which has brought us in some new investors. When I started this back in 2008, I was able to generate a lot of leads from investors, and some of the investors that are working with us today came from this. Is I would do case studies on the fix and flip properties. I'd buy a house, a trustee sale. I'd have the video camera going that day when I went out to it to get the locksmith to change the locks. Day 5, I would go through the rehab of the project. Day 10, it would be an update. Day 15, it's ready for the market. It's staged. It's market ready. Day 20, it's under contract. So I'd walk through these videos and do a case history of the project. Then I'd post them on YouTube and other social media sites. And the phone started ringing off the hook. I don't do that as much anymore just because of the value of my time. But it was a great way to get started, a low-cost way of getting started and getting the phone to ring with investors.
Wow. I'm sure there's a lot more I should be asking you about this project and this company. But I think at this point what I'm going to do is switch gears and talk about your more traditional brokerage, Show Appeal Realty, and start to go into that side of your business. So you've said you're down in Arizona. You've described your market. Could you tell me what niche, if any, you have for Show Appeal Realty? What's the focus of Show Appeal Realty?
Well, the focus of Show Appeal Realty is to leverage the power of technology in everything we do, from an admin brokerage standpoint, behind the scenes with the way we do commission disbursements, to our systems on how to turn in a new sale or a new listing. That's one of the behind the scenes technology things where we try to be different than a typical old school brokerage that is heavy and reliant on paper. With our we've developed different systems for lead follow-up, a CRM that once you submit an online form, it'll follow up with that client for 5 to 10 years down the road, and it's, you just kick back and relax knowing that the brokerage is taking care of your lead follow-up or after the sale follow-up with these clients. What we've looked at from a lead generation standpoint on the brokerage is, how do we get in front of where buyers are looking for properties or looking to potentially find an agent to sell a property? Of course, they're going online now. I mean, today's buyers are much different than buyers in the past. So we want to be at the forefront of their search. And the way I look at it is, instead of saying, I want to be the number one on Google for Arizona real estate or Phoenix real estate, I don't want that. I want to be number one on Google for the address 123 Main Street or MLS number 578214. That singular property, that's what I want to find a buyer for. I don't want to have to take the buyer through the whole funnel of trying to narrow down where they want to live. I want the person that already figured out they wanted 123 Main Street, and they're coming to me because they're Googling that address. So that's the way we looked at the concept, kind of like we mentioned earlier about reverse engineering things a little bit, is let's start with the address, the physical property, and build our online SEO strategy to target buyers who are looking for that house. And so that's what we've done online, is generate all these websites where we're ranking extremely well for an MLS number or a property address. And then we said, well, okay, let's peel back that onion, right? We started at the core of that onion. Let's peel back a layer and say, okay, well, the next step is the community or the zip code or the city or town. You know, just peel that back and look for how do we attract people that are more targeted with exactly where they want to live. It's a much easier referral and lead that we're getting out to agents in our brokerage. And they're further along in the decision-making process. And we've also done some other marketing steps to really set our brokerage apart, not only from the buyer's perspective, but we want to position ourselves to be geared towards sellers down the road when the market turns from less distressed sellers to more of your typical seller that has equity, where we've really spent a lot of time on the staging concept, that we have an in-house staging division in our brokerage. We've set up 180 community websites. So if I live in a community called Power Ranch, that if I went to Power Ranch Realtor in Gilbert, Arizona, I'm going to find our website, and I'm going to know that our brokerage services that community. And that's the same way we've incorporated it from a social media standpoint of, you know, how are we having Facebook fan pages on these communities in these areas, and how are we engaging the people that live in these areas, and how can we really tie in the whole online social media strategy into our real estate brokerage. I think that is a few examples of how our brokerage is kind of different from another brokerage in this marketplace.
You got a lot going on there. Let's try to break out some of those parts. The name of your company, Showpill Realty, it sounds like a staging company or has something to do with staging. So let's start there. You said you have an in-house stager. Do you have one person, a group of people? How many people are doing staging?
Well, we actually have one person now that handles most of our staging in our brokerage. You're right. Our name was kind of derived from staging concept because, you know, we heavily believe in it in our investment strategy because it's fundamentally been proven to work because real estate is an emotional process and it really pulls to the emotion of the home buyer and creates that connection of this could be my home, which is how we want them to feel instead of they're walking into someone else's house. So it's proven to work in our business model. So we want to make that a bigger focus on the brokerage side. And so what we looked at it as in the name of, well, you have curb appeal that describes the outside of the home. Well, something that has show appeal means it's going to show well or present well. So we just want to have that mindset of how we believe every client that's looking to sell their home should have it staged and properly ready for the market. And we should have a go-to consultant in our real estate brokerage that can be a staging specialist and could be that party that says, you know, you need to do this to your property to get the best value or the best showing ability for it.
Do you stage every listing that you have?
Every listing on the investment side, yes.
Okay. And for your agents in the brokerage, every time they get a listing, does your company provide staging services?
Exactly. And unfortunately, right now, most of the sales that we have in our brokerage are distress sales, meaning short sales, which, there's not as much time and effort, I guess, spent in the staging aspect of that. That's more of a price point thing than a staging thing. So a lot of our agents that are working with investors use it. And when the market turns around where there is more of a more, I guess, need for it from a traditional seller standpoint, I think we're going to be positioned for that change. And that's the whole thing. It might not be as prevalent now, but down the road, will it be? Yes.
Do you charge an additional fee for staging, or is it part of your overall package that you offer to a seller?
We do charge an additional fee for the staging, and it can vary from, you know, what needs to be done to the property to how much of the sweat and equity does the homeowner want to put into it by getting their house market ready. Typically, it'll range from around $700 to $1,500. Again, depending on, you know, is it just kind of a redesign of their current furniture, or is it bringing in some of the accessories and pictures and plants that on to a vacant home that will get it market ready?
Is that entire fee going to your stager, or are you splitting that with them?
That fee goes to our stager, and then we're able to take a percentage of that for the brokerage.
When you stage the properties, are you just working with the items that are already in the property, or are you also bringing in items such as furnishings and couches and tables and other things?
Well, we believe in the light staging. I think some stagers will call it the vignette staging, where it's just accessories. It's not big furniture. And we actually started off doing the big furniture, the coffee tables, the couches, the dining room sets. And we found that was not any more profitable than doing the light staging of just some pictures, some plants, some bathroom stuff. So to answer your question, we've gone away from the full-out staging to a more of a light staging, just because of the, number one, cost and return on investment. And number two, it depends on the house. Does it need pictures and accessories, or does it just need to be decluttered and cleaned up and someone to consult on, you know, what needs to be done to the property to get it ready for market?
Let's talk about that lead generation and break some of that out. That was pretty interesting how you're trying to break down your search parameters on Google and so forth into very small little niches. How are you achieving that? If you talked about a MLS number or an address, how are you getting the search engines to come find you for that?
Well, what we're doing is essentially creating our website into an MLS system with every single property indexed on our site. And a lot of agents, it gets kind of technical, but they have it, the search function on their websites framed in, right? So it's not really on their server. The page is not being indexed because there's no HTML by Google robots. What we're doing is essentially creating a huge database and optimizing each page for the address and MLS number. And there's companies out there that provide this kind of service. One of the companies that we use is Diverse Solutions, and they have a very good ID exchange function for WordPress blogs, which is, you know, I think it's $30 a month, and it's worth its weight in gold.
That software, it brings in properties through the IDX and then posts them on their own individual page?
Yeah, essentially it's you can almost think of it as an RSS to HTML. I mean, what essentially it does is say, instead of framing this in, we're going to create a optimized web page for that property that has all the HTML, the good stuff that Google really wants to grab, all the title, meta tags that Google wants to see that are geared towards that address or that MLS number, and how they can, and then essentially, if you're doing the right kind of linking and guest blogging, some other strategies and articles to really get your website ranking well to various pages, you know, Google's going to start indexing a lot of these single property pages on your website. And instead of being indexed, you know, you have 200 or 300 pages on your website, you're going to have 20,000-30,000 pages indexed. So when someone puts in 123 Main Street, they're going to that property and that address where they can view pictures, they can read a description, they can schedule a showing, and make the phone ring for you.
Are you doing this just for your own company listings, or are you also using listings out of the MLS?
We're using the whole MLS. Our MLS has a listing feed, a data exchange where brokerages can use it. A lot of brokerages don't understand why their listings are showing up on our website. But they fail to realize the data exchange policies that they agreed to with the MLS that allows us to syndicate this data. And, you know, it's really enhancing what is out there available to you and leveraging it to generate business. Because, look, we have the same intellectual capital and that forethought to actually make it happen. A lot of these brokerages can do the same thing we can do as far as they have access to the data exchange just as we do. However, we know how to use it and leverage that data to optimize it for the search engines, to maximize the results and leads into our brokerage.
Let's talk about one of those pages. 123 Elm Street is there. How are you converting that web page into a lead? Does the person have to call you? Do they type in a form if they want additional information? Do they email you? How do you get them from that page into your system?
Sure. They have multiple avenues to do that. One, they can schedule a showing via an online form where they say, you know, I want to see 123 Elm Street on July the 2nd at this time. They can pick up the phone and call us. We have a header that has obviously our phone numbers all over our website, and we have the call to actions too. I mean, you got to have call to actions to get people to pick up the phone to call. I mean, we have the mortgage calculators that they can see. We have the Zestimates from Zillow on there. So we have all this data that we're providing a potential buyer, but it's also not only can you provide them the information that they're looking for, but how do you make them fill out that form or pick up that phone and dial your number? And so we've done different call to actions on our website to really, you know, maximize the potential for people to call and inquire on the property.
For clarification, for some of our listeners that may not know what you're talking about, the call to action, what do you mean by that? Is it a phrase that you're using, a statement? What do you mean by call to action?
Well, a call to action can be very simple. It can be, you know, schedule a showing, schedule to go view this home today, or find out how low the mortgage payment would be on this property. So they fill out a form, anything that would really call to them to act upon, to get them to feel confident enough to release their contact information for you in order for you to make a sale. Because that's one of the great things, you know, about the web is you're anonymous. I mean, you can search and you don't have to fill out a thing, which is key to what we do is providing them knowledge, you know. But if you're not captivating that and capturing that buyer, that lead, by having these call to actions, they're just one click away to going to someone else's website.
So you're trying to entice them. That's the call to action.
That is the call to action.
And I assume there's an exchange. They'll give you their information, and you're going to give them something.
Exactly. Whether it's, you know, we're going to show them the property or provide more photos or, you know, tell them how much their mortgage payment would be. There's something that for them to provide their information, we're going to give them something in return.
Well, you have this large system set up now, this shadow MLS, so to speak. How's that working? How many website hits or leads are you generating? What kind of metric can you give me that's happening per day or week or month?
Well, I would say the best metric is we get about 30,000 unique visits a month to our websites. And keep in mind, we're a fairly new brokerage. I mean, we're pretty much only been operating for a year and a half now, not even actually. So a lot of our websites are relatively still young, and with getting indexed and up at the top of the search engines, you really need a pretty big history to really start moving up. So our trending of our statistics are definitely on the increase as far as number of unique visitors. And I would say on a given day, we get probably anywhere from 8 to 13 solid leads, meaning they want to see this property, not a lead like in, you know, I'm interested in Arizona real estate. No, lead as in I want to go see 123 Elm Street. So I'd say anywhere from 8 to 13 of those a day.
Okay, now I understand what you were talking about with your quote SEO strategy. You're basically trying to get into these search engines on this individual level and amplify that, not by having more people go to that individual page, but just by having a bajillion pages. Did you say you had 20,000 pages?
Yeah, on one of our main sites is indexed 20,000 pages deep. And one of the important things on a strategy is, well, 123 Elm Street might have just sold recently, And, you know, for that page to be taken off Google will take some time. You know, it'll be a, it'll be a broken link of a page. But what we've done is a redirect saying, oh, sorry, you know, 123 Main or Elm Street might be off the market, but here's some other similar properties that you might find interesting. So we found through looking at our analytics from our websites is a lot of the pages that people search for might already be sold, but Google hasn't, you know, unindexed that page from our website, so people are still hitting that page. So why not actually provide them with alternatives to what they're looking for to try to capture that sale?
It's kind of like Amazon when you buy a book and they ask you if you want another book with it.
Exactly. What else might complement or fit the needs of that parameter of what you're looking for exactly?
Let's talk about these leads. You're bringing them, these leads in. How are you capturing them? Are they going into some kind of central database, or do they just get handed out to your agents? What happens once that lead comes in?
Well, exactly. They're sourced out to our agents, and basically they're sourced out based on the area that the agent lives in throughout the Phoenix metro area, because the metro area is large, and it makes no sense to give someone a lead that lives on the east side of the valley a lead for a buyer looking to buy on the west side. So we go by territories pretty much in the brokerage, and then we go, and maybe a lot of agents don't like to hear this, but we give the majority of the leads to our best salespeople. Why is that? It costs money to get at the top of the search engines. I mean, it costs a lot of development time and resources to make this happen. And if we're giving them to salespeople that can't convert, we're just flushing money down the toilet. So we source our leads to a sales group within our company, the people that are dedicated to working these leads and have the track record that they're not going to spill these leads and they're going to do their due diligence and follow up to this client because it's based on results. And we want our best agents working these leads, so we're getting our referral fee off of them from the time and effort that we've put into developing the leads. And that goes to show is, you know, this should be a supplemental thing to our agent's business. This shouldn't be the core of what they do is handling our leads. This is something that is icing on top of the cake, the gravy on the mashed potatoes. This is us saying we're in the trenches with you guys on generating leads, and we want to show you something that we believe is a proven way for lead generation. And if you want to do this and implement this strategy in your business, here's what we did. Here's the book of how we did it and why we did it. Go do it if you want to.
And I can see it from your side, wanting to make sure that these leads convert. How do people make it into your exclusive club where they'll get these leads? How do you know who's the best person in the company or the best group of people in the company? What kind of track record do they have to have? How would a new person in your company prove themselves so they could get some leads?
Well, first off, what we do is we look at broker metrics, which is a software for brokerages where you can see what other agents are performing. You know, their statistics, the analytics on how many closings they've had, how many of those closings were buyer side, seller side, what price point, et cetera, what area of the metropolitan area was those sales in. So we really know if Jeff, for example, works on the west side of the Phoenix area that he closed, according to Broker Metrics, 8 buyer side leads over there last year. Well, you know, Jeff might be really good and maybe a potential candidate for who we bring on board to our brokerage based on him working that west side of the valley area and working with buyers because he has that history of doing so. And so if you're a new agent, what we have is a sales program in our brokerage where we try to get together once every 2 months and go through different sales techniques on how you can become a buyer's agent and work these leads more effectively.
This is the end of part 1. The interview continues on part 2.